The media landscape in America is busted. Americans are on to the omissions, the half-truths, and the outright lies being propagated against we, the people. Your host, Tom Harris, will bring you the other side of the story.
We have a relaxing treat for listeners this week. Rather than focusing on the critically important climate and energy issues that we usually concentrate on in the show, my co-host Todd Royal and I are going on a historical tour of Europe. It should be great fun. Our guide for this adventure will be no other than Bob Lyman, who I've had on the show in the past to speak about his specialty, namely the economics of energy and climate change. But Bob is also a connoisseur of European travel, in particular, travel to places of great historical interest. This tied in well with Bob's career with the Canadian government as he served as a Canadian diplomat for 10 years with postings in Caracas, Venezuela, and Washington, D.C. After graduation with an honors degree in international relations, perfect for this program, specializing in economics, political science, and history, Bob joined the former Federal Department of External Affairs. And so began his love affair with world travel. So welcome back to the show, Bob.
Well, thank you, Tom. That was a great introduction. I'm not sure I'll live up to it. I'm very enthused about the opportunity to speak about this.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of Christopher Monckton when he was introduced with an introduction that he thought was complimentary. And he said, oh, I can't wait to hear what I have to say. Yeah. So over to you, Todd.
Well, Bob, thanks for being on this. I mean, with the world on fire right now, I am very excited to be speaking with you today. It's nice to have a break from climate change and energy and international relations and all of that. So just tell everybody, our listening audience, which countries in Europe have you visited?
Well, I retired from the Canadian federal government in 2006, so it's been about 18 years ago. And during those 18 years, I've traveled to Europe about 20 times, in some countries multiple times, in other countries just a few. I've been to the United Kingdom. I've been to Ireland. I've been to France. I've been to Italy, Spain, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, and Greece, and the Netherlands. So 12 in all.
Wow. Now this is an obvious question I have to ask. So which ones were your favorites?
There are 44 different countries in Europe, and each one of them has a special attraction, a charm that will appeal to different people. In my case, because I really do enjoy history and culture and cuisine, I would have to say that France is probably my favorite, although it's only slightly ahead of Spain. I speak Spanish, so okay. I've traveled more extensively in Spain, and I've always enjoyed the trip there as well.
Yeah, you know, Bob, I found there was a huge difference between Spain in 1971 under Franco, which is when I went to Spain as a teenager, and then Spain today. Is that what you find as well, that getting rid of fascism made a big change in Spain?
Well, in many ways. I mean, it's certainly a freer country, but as you probably know, the reason why there was a Spanish Civil War was because of the strong differences among the regions. The Catalans in particular are very nationalistic. When you visit Barcelona, or if you visit any of the parts of Spain that were formerly part of Catalonia, you're constantly seeing people demonstrating in the streets about how proud they are to be Catalan. So, I mean, the freedom is paramount. It's evident in terms of the economic prosperity that you see all around you when you're in Spain, especially in Barcelona and the East Coast. But the regional differences continue to be quite profound, and it makes you wonder about what that will mean for the future of Spain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Now let's do the most important thing to me: the food. I have had some questionable meals in Spain. I had enough ham sandwiches to last me a lifetime. But you said you went to France. I had one of the best dinners of my life in Paris. So talk to me about food. What help me out here, because I'm supposed to go to Europe later this year, and my times I've been to Europe previously, outside of that lovely duck confit in Paris with a couple of bottles of wine, my food adventures have not been great in Europe. So what's some of the food that you like in some of the different places that you visited?
Well, France is definitely the epicenter of food for me, and then I think for the world. And I've had wonderful meals there in Paris in other parts of the country. You're constantly running into places that are Michelin starred, and that is a kind of a credential that is very much sought after and is earned by literally dozens of restaurants across France, not only in the larger cities, but also sometimes in the smaller cities. One of my favorite vacations was 2 weeks that I spent in a small village, really a hamlet called Verdra, which was about halfway between Nîmes and Avignon in the southern part of France. And I was there, and we stayed with a group in one of these VRBO rentals, and every day we would tour out in different directions from there to visit the wineries and historic places. And most of the time we would stop in small cities and just try the food in the restaurant. And they were always wonderful food, delicious. I mean, what's typical of French food, I would say, is their use of sauces, you know, they're very different from North America. North America, a lot of time people think, well, I want a really good steak, right? Well, if you want steak, you might as well stay in North America. Europe does not go for large amounts of meat, but the foods that they do make are wonderful. In much of the Mediterranean, the seafood is great. And did you try paella while you were in Spain?
I did. It was okay. Some of my meals when I was in Madrid, I remember I ended up having like an oxtail stew at this bar that would be open in the mornings. And because I got to the point that if I had another jamón, which is I have no Spanish except knowing that that meant ham in Spanish and then serrano, I was like, I've got to have something other than that. But I will say it was the best coffee that I've ever had in my life was in Spain. The coffees, the cafe, you know, the cafe con leche was just spectacular. So I was able to do a little bit of what you just asked.
Well, you have to remember too, that they eat at different times of the day than we tend to in North America. And paella in particular is prepared in the morning to be served at lunchtime. If you get there too late, or if you eat it in the evening, then it's all dried out and it's not very good at all. So you know you have to know when to eat these different things. I agree with you. I mean, in France, there are probably 12 different types of coffee that you can order, and each one more delicious than the last.
Yeah, between the coffees and when I was in Paris, now I think I did gain about 15 pounds while I was there because I had enough bread and chocolate croissants in between visits to the Musée d'Orsay that I can remember. But that's a good, I didn't realize that about the paella because I did have it. It's interesting you say that. I had it in the evening. I did have it in Madrid, and I think I had it one other time when I was in Barcelona.
Barcelona,
yes. I'm not saying it correctly. I definitely understand.
It's funny, my wife and I, we were in southern France, and the interesting thing was that when it was time for dessert, they brought a dessert tray, which had incredibly ornate and amazing desserts. And we were full, so we didn't have dessert. And they were quite offended. Oh, you won't have our dessert. So you should eat dessert when they offer it to you.
Well, I'm generally not one to pass up dessert, so I'll be okay with that. Hey, Bob, can I follow up with you a little bit about the south of France? I've never been. I've always wanted to go. So just tell us a little bit what you found so wonderful about the hamlet you were in and if you traveled around a little bit of the south of France.
Okay, well, the south of France is obviously the more temperate climate. It's also quite historic. I mean, there's places like Nice and Cannes on the south coast. which is the resort areas and the areas where they have the wonderful film festival. And Monaco is not part of France, but it's another destination there that lures a lot of wealthy people. And the beach at Saint-Tropez is something to be seen. I visited there for the first time when I was 18 years old, and I'd never been on a nudist beach before, and I was struck by the young French women, and that stayed with me as a memory, I assure you. One of the real attractions is the area Avignon. Avignon is a very historic city. It was at one time for, I think, about 60 years, it was the residence of the popes during the Middle Ages. And to this day, it's a wonderful place to visit. And there are other places like Arles and Aix-en-Provence, which are notable because there's so many Roman ruins there. And the Pont de Gard, which is another Roman ruin, is quite striking. I mean, when you go there, you are struck by the genius of Roman engineering.
Wow.
It's to this day is still an important part of the infrastructure of the southern part of the country. And I should not forget Carcassonne. Carcassonne is a completely walled city, which is a fairly large city, and for the most part, it is almost exactly the way it was in medieval times. So when you visit there, it is like truly stepping back in time, and you can enjoy the culture. And it's now it has become more occupied by tourist attractions and restaurants and so on than by the people who would live there. But it's truly wonderful as well.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Arles, because everyone's heard of the Colosseum in Rome, but they have a pretty amazing one in Arles, don't they?
Yes, they do, exactly. And I mean, it's not as big as the Colosseum in Rome. The Colosseum in Rome could house anywhere from 50 to 80,000 people. Whereas the one in Arles was not even half that size, but it's impressive to see.
It's also in perfect shape in comparison with the one in Rome.
Oh, and yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now we'll be uploading a PowerPoint presentation called A History Lover's Intro to Europe when this interview goes to podcast, which will be fun because it'll give people a listing of what we're talking about. But meanwhile, can you give us a short list of European destinations that you found most interesting from an historical perspective?
Yes, I will. And again, that's such a difficult question to ask because there are so many different destinations. When people think about tourism in Europe, and particularly about historical tourism, often they tend to think about castles and palaces and ancient architecture, the results of war, a devastation of war, and in the museums. And there are over 10,000 castles in Europe. There
Wow.
are over 600 major cathedrals in Europe.
Wow.
There are 30,000 museums in Europe. Not all of them are
Jeez.
historical, but many of them are. So there's so much to choose from. If I have to narrow it down, I'm thinking primarily of the places that I've been to, but I would say that Paris is number one. I mean, Paris is an absolutely gorgeous city. Paris has 50 world-class museums. If you decided to take a year of your life and just go and live in Paris and learn French, you could go to a different world-class museum every week. And by
Wow.
world-class, I'm saying that if they were in almost any other city in the world,
That'd
that
be
would be the
different.
main attraction for that city. So it's extraordinary. There are other places in France that are wonderful, but let me not forget the United Kingdom. London is absolutely fascinating, and it has a great many historical attractions. If you go to Oxford, University of Oxford, which I had the pleasure of attending for a whole 2 weeks once, you really do feel like you're stepping back in time. And I'm always intrigued by going up to Scotland and particularly to Edinburgh. Italy itself is a historical gem. I mean, and the three most famous cities and the ones that draw most tourists are Rome, Venice, and Florence, each for different reasons. And I've been to Florence three times. I must admit, I haven't been to Rome, but I've read, you know, as I'm sure you have, about all of the things that are there as well. So I think that there are places, individual places in other countries that are very impressive. The Acropolis in Greece is breathtaking.
Interesting.
And the archaeological museum in Athens that is based upon what is available to see in the Acropolis is, I'd say, the number two historical museum in the world. The number one historical museum in the world is the British Museum, which is just a fantastic place. If you want to think about places that are a little bit off the track, and I mean kind of surprising, there's places like Prague. Prague in the Czech Republic is absolutely fascinating because so much of it is still the way it was in medieval times. The central square in Prague is virtually the same. If you go out for a dinner, you're just as likely to end up in a medieval restaurant where they still have skulls in the ceiling and it's candlelit. So each of these places, they leave an indelible mark on you. I'll come back to a place that I immensely enjoyed, which is Florence, Italy. Florence was the center of the Renaissance, of course. And so when you go there and you stand in near the Uffizi Gallery, which is one of the great art museums in the world, it takes you back in time. You're kind of transported to a different era. And when you go in Florence, there's the major cathedral is called the Duomo, and the Duomo is not as big as St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome, but it's almost as impressive. And what's striking about it is as you enter the square where the Duomo is, you normally, of course, your eyesight is at the level of other people, and all of a sudden you see the crowd with their necks all turned up, and you look up. And you see this immense cathedral. I mean, truly immense, that was constructed in the 11th and 12th century. Before they had electricity, before they had any of the modern construction techniques that we have now, this extraordinary and beautiful cathedral was built. It is unbelievable. Venice, I'll have to admit, I haven't been to Venice, but when you read about all of the things that are there, ranging from the what was called the Doge's Palace. Doge was the name basically of the head of the government back when Venice was an independent republic, and the canals, the museums in Venice, all of it is truly awe-inspiring is the only word that I can use
for it. Is.
Yeah, I've been to Venice. I woke up early one morning and went to St. Mark's Square and watch the sun rise, and I still remember that. And remind me, in Florence, is the Duomo, isn't that Brunelleschi's dome, the famous Italian? Isn't it Brunelleschi's dome?
Yes,
is part of the Duomo. Yeah, the very famous, that he was centuries ahead of everybody, which is just stunning. Yeah, you're stunned when you look at it and go, this is the 11th century. How did they do all of this?
Yeah.
And you would love Rome. When I went to Italy, I did the traditional tour, the first tourist visit of the Rome, Venice, Italy. And Bob, hearing you would really love, you would love Rome.
Yeah.
Rome is magical.
I should tell you something funny about Florence. There is a museum called the Galileo Museum. And you walk into the part of the museum that deals with his things and shows his inventions and his original book in which he made fun of the Pope that he got into trouble for. But as you enter into the room, you're greeted by Galileo's finger. So he's giving you the finger. And of course, Galileo was a little bit of an ornery guy. So he gave a lot of people the finger. But apparently, and maybe you can say a bit more about this, Bob, I understand that in Europe, they like to have relics, a piece of a saint's hair, or in this case, Galileo's finger, which was really his finger. Is this common in Europe where they have bits and pieces of famous people?
Well, it certainly was in the Middle Ages, and I think it's been continued on. I mean, I mean, the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris is full of relics. And as you probably know, there was a major fire there a couple of years ago, and they're now rebuilding it in some ways that are a bit controversial. But most of the relics have survived, I believe. One of the famous churches in Spain is the Cathedral of Santiago, you know, where the people used to, in the Middle Ages and even today, people would do a pilgrimage to Santiago, starting in France and walking 800 kilometers to get to Santiago. But allegedly they have Santiago was James, I believe. And they have parts of his body there. I never really examining these in detail. Well, even in places like in England, the Canterbury Cathedral is a lovely destination to go to, and they have many famous people of British history entombed there. But they also have relics from earlier times as well.
Yeah. You know, I'll just go back to the Galileo Museum, because in our we did a bus tour with Trafalgar Tours, which was very good, actually, in 2019, just before the pandemic hit. And the Galileo Museum seems to be something that most people have not seen. Have you seen it, Bob?
No, I haven't.
Well, yeah. And when I bring up this particular part of Italy, people in Florence, people don't actually know about it. But, you know, the really cool thing about the Galileo Museum is when you'd walk into certain sections, it was like he was really there. And you might remember that he made fun of the Pope. He had this, dialogue of three world systems or something, or maybe it was two world systems, I can't remember. And on the cover, he had an editorial cartoon, which showed three people discussing. It was a very wise person. It was just a general member of the public. And it was somebody called Simplicio, who had the actual features of the Pope. And he was making Simplicio look like a moron. And of course, this didn't go over very well with the Pope. But when you walk around that particular museum, as I say, it's the Galileo Museum in Florence, and it's totally worthwhile. You walk and you see this man, he did such incredible things, you know, like civil engineering and astronomy. And you have his original telescope that he observed the moons of Jupiter and realized, wow, you know, the Earth is not the center of everything because those moons were zipping around. So I really recommend the Galileo Museum. It feels like Galileo is right there. And as I said earlier, to some extent he is, because a piece of his body is being, I don't know what they do with it. They somehow mummify it. So yeah, people got to look at that. What else in Florence did you find interesting?
Florence has several palaces, each of which is absolutely beautiful. And the Arno River that goes through the center of Florence, it kind of divides the city into different parts. I'm going to go back here a little bit to this topic of food again. I had wonderful experience with the food in Florence, but especially the wine. There are many countries of the world that produce wonderful wine, and France is probably the best, but Italy would come close to in terms of quality and variety of great wines. And when you're in Florence, everywhere you go, you're running into these wonderful wine shops. My daughter was married in Florence, and she her husband is a British lawyer who's done very well for himself in Dubai. So they were married in a palace overlooking the city.
Wow.
I'm glad I didn't pay for it. Let's put it that way.
That's a good wedding right there. That's a fun destination wedding.
It was extraordinary. And they even had an opera singer come and perform during the ceremony. That's the sort of thing that happens in places like Florence. It's just, you never know what's going to happen next.
We challenged you a few minutes ago with some of your good places, or, you know, Europe had a historical perspective. I want to say I loved how you described the south of France. I'm going to go put all these cities together, because I've literally been thinking about the south of France the last number of years and thinking, I really want to go there. And, you know, my wife and I, and so I'm going to take that. But what do you also see, though, is like some unmissable historic sites to visit in Europe? You said a few, but if you really had to kind of narrow the gap, what would you say are just, man, if you're over in Europe, if you're in this country or these areas, here's some historic sites you really need to go visit?
Well, again, I'm going to be a little bit repetitive here, but certainly in England, I think you should see Westminster Cathedral. I think people should see Buckingham Palace. I think absolutely must see the British Museum, which is probably one of the preeminent museums in the world, and it's free to get into.
Sorry to interrupt, but what's the attraction of the British Museum?
The British Museum is the historical museum of the UK. It's it's not just of history of the UK. It's the history of mankind, and it's extraordinary.
And they have the Egyptian things there, right?
Yes, they have several exhibits from Egypt as well. I loved the Churchill War Rooms in the UK. They've recreated all of the working space that the Churchill War Team had during that period of time. And you go in there, and it's extraordinarily well animated, and they've used modern technology along with the actual spaces and workspaces and desks that they had from the 1940s. And it's just intriguing, very, very intriguing for anybody who has an interest in the history of the Second World War. I think that in France, I mean, Paris and the Louvre, the museum of basically the French military, which includes the Napoleon's tomb, is quite fascinating as well. In Germany, I've been into a number of places, particularly in the south. There's a part of Germany which is called the Romantic Road, which goes south from the Munich area down into Bavaria, and it's probably one of the most charming and well preserved parts of Europe for those who are interested in medieval history. Austria is an absolute gem, particularly in Vienna and Salzburg. You're talking about seeing marvelous cathedrals and castles and palaces, that part of Europe was during the Holy Roman Empire was probably the most advanced part of Europe, and a lot of that that beauty is still retained. I'm not talking about the other places, but that are kind of unmissable. But I would suggest that if you do go to Greece, in addition to going to the Acropolis, which is unmissable, you should also go to the ruins at Delphi, which are they're not in a city. They're near. There is a town called Delphi, but it's some distance away from the ruins. They've managed to keep that area still much the same as it was, when Apollo was being honored, and when Zeus was regarded as the person who must be obeyed.
Unfortunately, we have to go for a break now. We've got a little overtime. It's so fun. We're going to be right back, and I hope you can continue with Greece, because I've never been there. My wife's been there, and she was super impressed. Our guest today is Robert Lyman, who's taking on us on a historic tour of Europe, which is really fun. So stay tuned. We'll be right back after the break. Before we go to the break, I'd like to tell everybody about a new ready-to-eat metabolic health bar that I've started to make a regular part of my diet. It's called Heal Right, and it isn't just any old health food bar. It was developed after over 15 years of research by National Medal of Science recipient Dr. Bruce Ames and a team of scientists at University of California, San Francisco, Benioff Children's Hospital and Research Center at Oakland. Dr. Ames and his team developed Heal Right to address the epidemic of obesity and related diseases through micronutrition. They realized that the problems that many of us face with our health are not just due to consuming the wrong things, such as too much trans fats and sugar, but it's also due to the lack of sufficient micronutrients in our diet. In other words, the vitamins and minerals we need to be healthy. And that's the beauty of Heal Right food bars. Rather than having to consume countless vitamin and mineral pills and guessing at the correct dosages, these good-tasting bars give us over 20 essential micronutrients, antioxidants, fiber, proteins, and many other building blocks that promote high levels of health. To order HealRight Metabolic Health Bars, go to AmericaOutloud.shop and scroll down until you see the ad for HealRight. Then click on the HealRight ad and select Learn More to choose your order. I like caramel apple fig best. It's really wonderful. When you place your order, be sure to use the code OUTLOUD to receive 20% off, an exclusive benefit for the America Out Loud family of listeners and readers.
World-class care from doctors you can trust, all from the comfort of your home. That is One Wellness. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company launched the One Wellness membership to provide free monthly supplements and unlimited telemedicine access with doctors that share your values. Be a part of a revolutionary new healthcare system that puts your health and well-being above the interests of Big Pharma's bottom line. It's the way healthcare should be. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first month of One Wellness.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Take action today. Visit healright.com/outloud or americaoutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
The buildup of spike proteins is dangerous to your health. Global Healing's Foreign Protein Cleanse detoxes your body, removing the spike proteins, allowing your body to repair from within. Formulated by Dr. Edward Group and by Dr. Brian Artis, Foreign Protein Cleanse targets and detoxes spike proteins in the body. Go to AmericaOutloud.shop and get 15% off using the code OUTLOUD. Global Healing, giving you the power to take control of your health naturally.
Who's got time for a nasal invasion messing up your lifestyle? Crush those nasties before they become a problem. For a limited time, when you add the new Cofix RX throat spray to your order with the coupon code OUTLOUD, you'll receive 20% off the entire purchase. Go to AmericaOutloud.shop. That's AmericaOutloud.shop. And use coupon code OUTLOUD.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death and disability. Lifestyle changes are critical, but you can also support your heart with concentrated nutrients. Healthy Cell created heart and vascular health to support cholesterol and blood pressure with CoQ10, vitamin K2, resveratrol, and soluble fiber. And Healthy Cell's not a pill. It's a patent-pending gel you swallow. Get heart healthy. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. HealthyCell.com. Code out loud for 25% off.
When God, through His grace and mercy, gave us free will, the will of the people was to live freely. To that end, we fight for the liberty of all at a time when global tyranny threatens us as never before in mankind's history. This vision is manifest at AmericaOutloud.news, a site for all who cherish free will and freedom. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
We're back with my co-host Todd Royal and our guest today, who's our tour guide on a trip across Europe, a historical trip across Europe, and that's Bob Lyman. So Bob, you were talking about Greece. Can you say a little more about Greece? Because I've never been there, but I understand it's one of the unmissable places.
Well, it definitely is. The most interesting from a historical perspective is, of course, the monuments that are in Athens and or nearby Athens. People tend to forget that Greece has 6,000 islands, and only about 200 of which are actually occupied. Those are most famous because of places like Santorini, which are very high-end and beautiful places to go to, but they're not so much historical appeal. Because actually, Santorini is built on an island that was created as a result of a volcano that erupted only about 6,000 years ago. And so it's very different from many of the other islands. But the other major island is Crete, and Rhodes. Crete and now Rhodes is a closer to Turkey than it is to the rest of Greece. But Rhodes is an island that is much more historical in the sense that the buildings are older and they're of the design of centuries ago. Whereas Crete is a bit more modern. The most famous site in Crete from a historical perspective is what we call the palace at Knossos. And it's very, very impressive. You'll see it on all the tourist literature. As I say, it tends to be a little bit criticized because when it was being redone, they painted it with different colors that are different than those that were obviously used in historical times. So if you're a purist, it's not quite as impressive.
I had a quick question, Bob. I read, and maybe you can tell me if this is true, that the original statues from Greece were not gray, that they actually painted them with human flesh colors, and that they were actually quite colorful. Is that true, or is that somebody's imagination?
I think that's true. I have to say that Greece is a country that is undergoing really significant economic problems these days. I mean, it's heavily in debt, They're constantly having to be bailed out by the European Union and the IMF. So when you go there, you really see a country that seems to be in somewhat in decay. Athens, kind of full disclosure here, I was pickpocketed in Athens. They got my wallet and my passport because I went on to the metro system without being careful enough to protect myself. But that's unfortunately typical because of the really depressed economy there. So if you go there, I mean, I'm not suggesting that it's not a wonderful place to visit from a tourism perspective or from a history perspective, but people who go there need to be especially careful from a personal security perspective.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I want to return back to museums. You had talked about our previous segment. Remind me, I think that you said is it 10,000 or 50,000 museums you'd said that are within Europe?
Over 30,000 museums.
Over 30,000. Oh, okay.
Wow. Gosh,
incredible. You could spend a lifetime doing that. What, in your view, are some of the most interesting history museums in Europe?
Well, the most interesting history, I've already mentioned the British Museum, and the Acropolis Museum, but the Archaeological Museum of Spain, which is in Salamanca, is also extremely appealing, as is the Archaeological Museum, which is in Naples, Italy. In terms of other museums, well, of course, I haven't mentioned Russia, which is not exactly a place that one is likely to travel to in the near future, but the Grand Peterhof Palace in Russia is one of the truly great historical museums in the world. One of my personal favorites is the Museum of Medieval Armor, which is in Italy. People don't kind of think about it, but it's great. I mentioned the Churchill War Rooms. You can't forget that there was some horror in the past. And if you go to the Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum in Poland, you'll leave with indelible memories. Those are ones that I would mention as some of the most impressive ones that I've been to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are these museums free, or are they expensive, or what?
No, they generally speaking, the fees to get in tend to be in the range of $20 to $30, except in the UK, where many of the most important museums are free.
Oh, wow. That's great. Now, one place you haven't touched on, which you and I were speaking about before, is Belgium. That's surprising. You were saying there's actually one particular place in Belgium that is very interesting historically.
Bruges. Yes, Bruges is a city that when you would tend to think, they call it the Naples, or sorry, the Venice of the North, because there's so many canals that link the different parts of the city. But all along the canals are these medieval buildings, and you could go through the city touring it and really feel like you're stepping back in time. Now, mind you, I mean, what Belgium is famous for, among other things, is chocolates and beer. And I have someone who really enjoys a variety of beer. There are hundreds of different types of beer in the Bruges and the other places in like Brussels and others in Belgium are good attractions there. Now Bruges is also quite close to some of the major World War I battlefields. Canadians will always know of the Battle at Ypres, we haven't talked about those sorts of things as well. But being when you go to Bruges, you're bound to take a little bit of a visit and see the main First World War battlefields and the museums that are associated with them.
Yeah. Now, is Belgium mainly French speaking or what?
It's half French, half Flemish.
Flemish. Okay.
Yeah, Flemish is close to Dutch, I believe, in terms of the structure of the language.
Mm-hmm. And do you find the people in Belgium friendly?
Oh yes, very, very. I mean, my French is a little bit rusty these days, but there's a very different accent in Belgium than there is in France, The French make fun of the French Canadian accent, but they make it even more fun of the Belgian accent as well.
Well, maybe that was why they were laughing at me. My teacher in high school in Quebec, because I grew up in Montreal, was a Belgian teaching me French. So I never quite understood why the Parisians laughed whenever I spoke French to them. So that's funny. That's interesting to hear. They kind of look down on Belgian French.
Well, the British look down a little bit upon how Americans and Canadians speak as well.
Oh, yeah. My grandmother was from England, and we kept saying to her, it's not Winnie the Pooh Baya. What's a Baya? It's hilarious. The different accents are fun, you know. So which languages do you speak then? French, Spanish, English?
Yeah, my Spanish is pretty good. My French is rusty. My English is improving all the time.
Yeah. So now the last question, because we only have about 10 minutes to go. What are some examples of places that you might go to see history as real life? You know, that is people celebrating the past through festivals and cultural events and practices.
Well, that's a two-part question, you know, or a two-part answer, I guess, to that, Tom, because people live much the way they did centuries ago in some of the poorer countries, and that's not to entertain us. But if you go to places like Slovakia or Romania or parts of Croatia and certainly other parts of the Balkans, you'll very much see people living much the way they did years and years ago. But in terms of the celebration of the past, there are a number of festivals that you just can't miss. I mean, if you're planning to travel to Europe in the summer months, a good thing to do is to check ahead of time to find out where all of the summer festivals are, because they start at the beginning of the summer and they go right through to the end of September. The number one place is definitely the Carnival, which is celebrated in Venice, where thousands of people get dressed up in these extraordinarily colorful costumes and masks and celebrate in the streets for weeks. Number two in my book, and this is, again, because I speak Spanish, is the Festival of San Fermín, or as it's more popularly known, the Running of the Bulls in Pamplona, Spain. The Running of the Bulls has been famous since Ernest Hemingway wrote his first novel, which was As the Sun Rises, I believe, if that was the title. Anyway, but Pamplona once a year for a week turns to this extraordinary chaos where everybody walks around with red kerchiefs off and prepares either to watch the bulls or to actually run with the bulls. It's a cultural event that's extraordinarily unique.
Can you describe it? Because, like, what are they doing? It sounds pretty dangerous.
Well, it is dangerous. And apparently throughout history, there's been about 15 people that have actually died as a result of running with the bulls. But they what they do is they have the bulls in a pen at one part of the city. And they have the streets that go from the pen to the bull ring. And what they do is they put up barricades along the sides of the streets, and people sit, you know, in seats along the way. And then a bunch of young men, they tend to be typically young men, will go down into the area between where the bulls are and where the stadium is. And then they open the gates, and dozens and dozens of bulls go rushing down the street to free themselves, basically, with all of these young men running in front of them, and hoping to stay out of the way of the horns. It's colorful, all right, but it's certainly dangerous.
Sounds like color would be blood, eh?
Yeah, the color is sometimes blood. Number three, I guess, has got to be the Oktoberfest in Germany. You know, in held in the fall. It usually goes on for a little over a week, and it's centered in Munich, but it's celebrated in all parts of Bavaria. It's a wonderful festival. I mentioned that I happen to be a bit of a beer lover myself. Over the course of the week, there are thousands of people here. They have been known to drink something like 6,000 gallons of beer. that's what I call a party.
Yeah.
So. I mean, and of course they often are dressed up for it as well, and there are other places. The Highland Games in Scotland are one of the lesser known ones, but are truly appealing to people who have a kind of a British heritage. The Highland Games are ones where they celebrate women, and they play different, you know, Scottish music and Scottish dancing and so on, but they also practice some of the historical sports, like the caber toss or the hammer toss that were originated in Scotland years ago. In France, they have Bastille Day. That's July the 14th, which is their national holiday, but it's celebrated everywhere, you know, and with parties and music and so on. Well, those are the main ones. But every place that has its festival that's one of the best things about the Europeans. They really know how to have a good time.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. That is a wonderful part of Europe. I was curious, because you had mentioned a little while ago about some of the different, the World War One battlefields. Had you had an opportunity to go up to Normandy? I've known some folks that have visited there, and they say it is I can't think of the words. It's obviously not surreal, but they said it's sobering. Just an unbelievable, sobering experience, and it's an incredibly well done monument in that whole area. Have you visited that?
I haven't. In about 6 weeks' time, that's exactly where I'm going to be.
Are you really?
Yeah, I'm traveling to France. I'm going to do a tour starting in Paris and going through the Loire Valley, staying in Tours for a while, and going up to Saint-Malo, which is in Brittany, and then to Caen, which is really the center of the Normandy area, before going to Rouen and back to Paris. The Normandy landings, of course, are where a lot of the both the museums and the cemeteries are. And for Americans, I'm sure that the Omaha Beach and Utah Beach would be places of sadness. For Canadians at Juneau Beach, there's a large Canadian cemetery there, and there's a larger British Commonwealth exhibit, and beyond that, I mean, the that's the Second World War. There are First World War battlefields that are also in that area as well, so it's a. I don't know if you've ever been to a small cemetery, you tend to think mm-hmm. of a few hundred, but there you're talking about thousands and thousands of graves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's really quite striking.
No, I've been to Arlington National Cemetery, and it has that same kind of feeling. Gettysburg visit there before as well. And you're right. When you visit those kind of areas, it's very sobering when you see thousands upon thousands.
Mm-hmm. I should tell you, both of my grandparents, my grandfathers, were in the trenches in World War I, and one of them wrote a book, actually quite a good book. He was an English professor, so he was a good writer, called And So We Joined the Army. And it talks about how when they joined, they had very high ideals of God, Queen, and country. But after a couple of years in the trenches, it was like blood, mud, and gore, you know, like it was a very different perception after a couple of years. It's actually in the War Letters Project out of the University of Victoria. And so I'll put that book, a link to that book, on the podcast when it goes up on Monday, because it's pretty amazing to see what they went through. And the fact that I'm even here is kind of remarkable. You know, Bob, just to end off, tell us I know this is summarizing a bit, but what are the lesser known places that you think people should now know about as a result of this interview?
Well, I really enjoy the Czech Republic, and I think that people who may not have ever thought about going there should go to Prague. It's affordable, it's historic, it's charming, the food is very good.
What language do they speak?
Czech.
Oh, okay.
Right. And there's another smaller town, and it's only 13,000 people in the Czech Republic, called Český Krumlov, which again is very much like stepping back in time. I haven't spoken at all, unfortunately, about Budapest and Hungary. And Budapest is an absolutely gorgeous city. It's got about 12 different universities, a long history. It's charming. Absolutely mm-hmm. charming in terms of his exhibits. If you want something that's very little bit outside the pale, Romania. There's a Sighișoara in Romania is near Bran Castle. And if you may recall that Bran Castle is the historic home of Vlad the Impaler, who is the historic inspiration for the Dracula myth. So people to this day who want something totally different will go to Romania and they'll go visit the Sighișoara and the nearby Bran Castle. And if they're a fan of the movie Young Frankenstein, they can relive it themselves. So those are a couple of the places that I definitely were. I mean, we haven't really spoken about Portugal, which I will.
Oh yeah, we have a couple of minutes. So yes, can you say something about Portugal?
Yeah, Portugal is primarily known nowadays for the southern area because there's such wonderful beaches there. But the northern part of Portugal, Lisbon up to Porto, is a wonderful area, both historically and culturally, There's a smaller town. There's a town called Óbidos in the southern part of Portugal, in the interior, which has a wonderful medieval festival every year. One thing I didn't talk about at all in terms of eras of history is something called La Belle Époque. La Belle Époque, which is primarily celebrated in France, it was that period from the end of the Franco-Prussian War in, I think, 1871, and the beginning of the First World War. It was an era of marvelous cultural and economic expansion in Europe. Mm. And what's left behind nowadays are wonderful buildings from that era, including extraordinarily beautiful restaurants. And if you ever have the opportunity to go to Porto, you will find a few restaurants there that are in that custom as well. And of course, Paris has got several, but Portugal is got. You talk about food. It may not. I would suggest Portugal has better food than Spain. So that's something I would invite you to try sometime.
Yeah. So after hearing this, I'm going to have to talk to my wife about going to Belgium. Bruges. I mean, that to me is the gem that I never heard of, quite frankly. And now I know something about it. And I should tell our listening audience, we're going to put some slides up which lists many of these places. So if you're frantically taking notes, just check in on Monday and we'll have a lot of these places listed in a 10-page PowerPoint slide. So Todd, that was fun, eh? And you say you're going to...
I think I'm going to do the romantic road of Germany. That sounded wonderful and beautiful all at the same time after my South of France tour. So yeah, thank you so much for this, Bob.
Yeah, that was great. So we have to sign out, unfortunately, but I can't wait to talk to Lori about this, my wife, because I've got some really neat ideas for trips, and in particular, Bruges. That sounds really cool. And lots of beer, that's for sure. So, Bob, thanks so much for being our guest today. It was a real nice treat to have something very different, but really entertaining and applicable, quite frankly. So, thanks, Bob, for being on our show.
My pleasure. Invite me again. I'll come back talk about something else about Europe.
Okay, that's great. There's lots of things to discuss. So this is Tom Harrison, my guest, Bob Lyman, with our co-host, Todd Royle, signing out from the other side of the story. Before we end the program, I'd like to remind listeners to check out these Heal Right food bars. Okay, they contain over 20 essential micronutrients, antioxidants, fiber, protein, and many other building blocks that promote high levels of health. To order these Heal Right bars, go to americaoutloud.shop and scroll down until you see the ad for Heal Right. Then click on the Heal Right ad and select Learn more to choose your order. As I said earlier, I love caramel, apple, fig best. Well, anyway, when you place your order, be sure to use the code OUTLOUD to receive 20% off. That's an exclusive benefit for the America Out Loud family of listeners and readers.